change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, this is Mickey Desai. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. I'm very happy today to be talking with Rita Sever. Rita is a consultant and the author of Leading for Justice, a really cool and interesting no-nonsense book about supervision, HR, and culture. Rita, how are you?
Hi, Mickey. I'm doing well. Nice to talk to you.
Definitely glad we had finally got time to do this. I know we had to bounce around our schedules a bit, and I had unfortunately a memorial to go to in the middle of all of our shenanigans, but I'm glad this finally worked out, and I hope you're having a good day.
I am, and I'm very excited to talk to you about my book and the work and nonprofits, so yay.
Let's start with the big picture. How did you get involved in this industry? How did you get involved with this subject matter?
I got involved going all the way back to my childhood. I grew up the youngest of six children, and so I grew up with a fierce understanding of what it feels like to be, to feel that life is unfair, to feel unseen, unheard, not in any dramatic way, but just in the way of a lot going on.
Sure.
So when I started my business career, I wanted to make the world better. I wanted to help make things a little more fair. And so I was drawn to the nonprofit sector. I worked internally in nonprofits for many years, started out at an AIDS agency back in at the height of the epidemic. And then I worked at a community action agency, which had Head Start and health and youth programs. And then I started my own business, and I have a background in human resources and organizational psychology. And so now I work with social justice organizations doing coaching, consulting, and training.
Very cool. Remind me what part of the country you're in?
I'm in California.
But of course, you can work virtually anywhere.
I do and have been. Yes. Yeah. I have clients all over the country.
Yeah, I'm sure that in the last 12 months in particular, your calendar must be packed these days. There's certainly a lot going on in the general conversations that we have about race, about equity and inclusion. Have you found that to be true? Are people more keenly interested in the subject matter?
Yes, there is a lot of interest in how do we take these ideals, these values, and make them concrete for our staff. So yes, I have been very busy, and it's very exciting work.
Yeah, even on my desk too. You know, the question is, how do we diversify our nonprofit boards? How do we make sure that the nonprofit is thoroughly looking at issues of equity from, you know, top to bottom? I'm glad to see that more nonprofits are open to having those conversations. But let's talk about your book. If you don't mind, I thought maybe a good approach to it would be just to lightly walk our way through the table of contents, just to, you know, get the broad picture of what the book is all about. I got to say, I like the no-nonsense language in here. I like it that it's full of tips, you know, how to make it your own, how to push for cultural change on top of just implementing cultural change. You even dropped the S-bomb in here at least once. And I don't know if I can get away with saying the S-bomb on the word because on the podcast, because that word may still get me into trouble, even though it's my own podcast. What prompted the book? How did you come up with the wherewithal just to encapsulate all this between two covers of a book?
I've been working with social justice organizations, as I said, and even back to my days at Community Action Partnership, I was immersed in diversity work, is what we called it back then. And I learned more and more working with my clients, and I noticed a theme that there was a lot of attention and a need to apply the work for justice that they were doing externally to bring it internally. Mm-hmm. And so I started writing my thoughts down. I send out a monthly newsletter. So this was, some of this is from that. And I realized a couple years ago that I had a lot to say about this, so I decided to put it all together.
Right, and it's very well organized. You start up in the beginning with the chapter topic, how do you show up as a manager, and it just sort of drills down from there. What would you hope, I mean, this is a really stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Who's the book for, and what do you hope they get out of it?
The book is for any leader who is vested in justice, who really cares about the values of making the world better, of making the world more equitable, particularly those in the nonprofit sector, because that is where I live and work. So I know the pitfalls in that arena, and I know the strengths in that arena. But it's really for any manager who wants to pay attention to that. And I hope they will come away from this book with some real practical tools that they can say, ah, I hadn't thought of that before. Let me try this.
Right. Right. So for nonprofit leaders in particular, what are the unique challenges that you think nonprofits and in particular social justice and organizations, what are their challenges? What do you typically see those folks wrestling with?
So the challenges I see, some of the challenges I see are the fierce commitment to making the world better, to bringing justice, to organizing their members, their clients, to focusing on their mission. But then internally, there's still the scarcity mindset. So people aren't paid what they should be, of course. That's an anthem of any nonprofit.
Sure.
At the same time, there's sort of a psychological contract that, okay, we know we won't be paid as well, but we want in exchange to get flexibility, to be treated fairly, to be met with respect, to have an input on decision-making. And all of that is unspoken. And sometimes what's unspoken then leads to misunderstanding. So I think just the challenges of how do you give staff a voice without saying we're a collective, unless you decide to be a collective, and how do you make sure you're on the same page with what that looks like and how it's going to play out? That's one of the challenges.
So can we walk this one back a little bit and paint a little more plainly the picture of what scarcity mindset has to do with equity, inclusion, and justice?
Great. Yes, that's a really good, important, basic question. Because we come to the nonprofit sector with the scarcity mindset, we're always, first of all, there's never enough. That's the definition of a scarcity mindset. So right. Anybody asking for a raise or time to attend a training or other kinds of benefits or perks, the first answer is almost always we can't afford it. Second of all, and probably even more intensive in terms of the impact, is this mindset that because we don't have enough, we have to put all our resources externally. We have to prioritize our mission and our external work to the sacrifice of the staff. But of course, in reality, looking at the big picture, whatever money you have, if you invest some of that in staff, you're going to get better results. You're going to increase retention and productivity and morale, and therefore do better work for your clients.
So the next pieces of your book are all about...
Can I add one more thing to that?
Of course, yes.
Because I realize I didn't answer specifically the equity part of that. So sure. The way I think the scarcity mindset that specifically impacts equity is that we do what we have always done because we know how to do it. It's right in front of us. It doesn't cost anymore. And when we do that, we are inadvertently replicating the dominant white supremacist system. And therefore, that has a huge impact on people of color and other marginalized staff who are not brought in as well as they could be.
That makes sense. Okay. Thank you for adding that. I was wondering how I was going to come back around to that, because you're right. I mean, the scarcity mindset is something that not a lot of us are really conscious of. As you said, it's sort of an ingrained cultural piece of what it means to be running a nonprofit, and we're doing it and we don't know we're doing it. Right. And that's, I think that ties in with some of the next things in your book, which is, how do you identify certain things that you need to change? You're looking at cultural change, looking in the mirror, things like that. And of course, I'm grossly paraphrasing things. How do you get someone to do that? How do you get someone to look in the mirror, not only as a person, but as an organization?
Yes, that is the first fundamental question. And I think the best way to do it is to connect the value of their mission to the need to look in the mirror. That you will be more effective if you as an organization can walk your talk more effectively. And you as a leader will be more effective if you know how you show up, how you're perceived, and your impact on other people.
Right.
Both of those will help you be more effective in meeting your goals and your mission.
What's your favorite part of this book? I mean, I know it's your baby and you like every single part of it, but was any part of it easier to write than any other part? Or is there any part of it that you think is more critical than the rest of the book?
Well, you're right. I can't pick one part. but I will say that the chapter on looking in the mirror, on self-awareness, is, I think, the foundation again, that if leaders can do that and learn to make that part of their approach to leadership, that will go a long way. Mm-hmm. It will help them be open to hearing feedback and to understanding what's happening and how they're showing up. Yeah. The misses and messes, that's from my work, and I call it misses and messes, but I say that with love because I'm all about nonprofits, and I just want to point out, in one of the areas I think I talk about, wait, there's a sink in the living room, because nonprofits grow organically. And at some point, it is as if they said, why do we have a sink in the living room? Meaning, why is our tech person also doing client services? And that's one of the misses and messes I talk about.
Right.
And then the S-bomb is that chapter was also hard to write, but so important.
Well, if anyone's curious, the S-bomb is basically how to own your stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. Except it's not stuff, right? So to me, the one of the chapters that I thought was extremely valuable was the one on holding accountability, which I think is a baseline challenge for a lot of nonprofits, just universally, right? Not even with regard to the diversity picture, the social justice picture, but, you know, you have board members and staff members who are saying that they're going to do something and then nothing happens, you know, or they join a board with this sort of implicit agreement that they're going to do certain number of things for the organization, and then those things don't happen. So can you speak for a moment about accountability tools? What do you think works best? What do you find yourself suggesting the same thing to nonprofits? Can you speak about that for a little bit?
Absolutely. And yes, that accountability is probably one of the things I get consulted about and coach and train on the most often. My business is actually called Supervision Matters because I think so much of the positives and the ills in nonprofits and any business go back to the supervisor. And that's where accountability is in terms of staff. And so I teach my clients to, first of all, make clear what you need, what your expectations are, and to give clear, respectful feedback. And that includes just noticing, as you said, when something isn't done, name that.
Yeah.
Not in a judgmental way, but just, hey, I thought you were going to get me the report today. What happened? I don't have it. Because so many times, again, this is one of the challenges of nonprofits. Nonprofits are full of nice people, good people, kind people. And sometimes that gets in the way of just having these conversations that aren't mean or bad, but we're uncomfortable calling somebody on, hey, you didn't do what you said you were going to do. And we need to figure out how to do that in a kind way, not get hung up on being nice, but being kind.
Well, as you said, it's not supposed to be a judgment, you know, and there's that place of leadership where you simply keep tabs on what needs to get done and you just get it done. And it's not a punishment and it's not a lecture. It's it's just a nudge, you know, hey, how's this coming? Right.
Yeah, it's really, I talk a lot about how feedback is simply information. information that staff or anyone, peers, your own supervisor, information they need to help you and the organization be successful.
Right. Rita, there's so much stuff to talk about in this book. I mean, everything from cultural change, talking about HR, which a lot of nonprofits don't have their own HR divisions, of course. I wanted to shift gears for a little bit and talk about what your perspectives are coming away from the age of COVID. I mean, we're technically still in a state of pandemic. People are starting to return to their lives as if it's over, and it's not over. Let's talk about social justice and what that means for nonprofit leadership as we're continuing to deal with whatever happens over the next 6 months. What does a post-pandemic world look like for the nonprofit sector?
That's going to be really interesting to see. I think one of the things that we will see is a lot more dispersed workforces. I've worked with a couple of groups that have been totally virtual for years. And I think that is the model that we're getting to.
Yeah.
I hope that if whatever part we do get to in terms of being virtual, I hope the scarcity mindset won't stop organizations from getting together in person when we can, because that is also critical. It might be a retreat 2, 3, 4 times a year, but people need to be in the same space sometimes when it's safe. But in terms of, hiring without geographical boundaries is going to be a real interesting turn of events that's been happening over the past year, and I think it will continue to. In some ways, I think being so focused on Zooming and being virtual, we've recognized that we can't just be totally productive focused. Or productivity focus, because we still need to make time for the personal connections, the interpersonal connections.
Right.
And I think at the start of the pandemic, people weren't doing that because they couldn't. They didn't have the bandwidth with taking care of family and figuring out how to do this. Nobody had time for that. But when we lose that time for a conversation and connection, we start to lose our culture. We start to lose trust, and we start to lose the fun of it. And so I think that's something that we're coming around to full circle to realize that, yes, there's values to this virtual work, and we can't lose the personal connection.
Right. Paradoxically true. I don't know if that term applies here, but on the one hand, we desire a culture that gives people the flexibility to work from home and to stay remote and do things like that. On the other hand, doing that allows us to stay in our respective silos and not really pay attention to the issues that are in front of us in terms of, race, social justice, differences, making things equitable. So it's one of those weird things. Letting people work remotely kind of promotes equity, and letting people work remotely also allows us to stay in our silos, which is why I agree with you. I think it's important that we do touch base and, meet face to face at least periodically as a crucial part of what it means to move forward as an organization.
Absolutely. And it's also one of the hard parts is building in time for hard conversations and conflict resolution, because that is going to happen but as we increase diversity, there's going to be more misses, more just not assumptions made, and we're going to have more disagreements, not right. Because of anything bad, but just because we all have our own assumptions and our hidden rules. Organizations have hidden rules, and hidden rules is one of the places where if you know them, you're in, and if you don't know them, you're judged by them. And so in a virtual world, that can happen without even knowing it. It can in person too, but even more so virtually.
Yeah. Yeah. Rita, the book again is called Leading for Justice. Where can I find it? And how would a listener get in touch with you if they had any questions for you?
Great. You can find it any place you get books, bookshop.com, Amazon. You can order it through your local bookstore. And my website is supervisionmatters.com.
Excellent. Rita, this is, again, wonderful stuff. There's way too much more to talk about, and I hope the reader can get into it, because there's the whole document is just full of tips and tricks. And like I said before, just a no-nonsense approach to staying on top of these things. And I hope I wish you a lot of success with this endeavor. And thanks for letting me interview you about the book today. Thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Mickey. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks to Rita's generosity, we're going to actually give away a copy of Leading for Justice to one of our listeners. If you'd like the book, please contact me via my website. That's the nonprofit snapcast.org, and drop me a note. I will pick a winner at random for anyone who drops me a note who says they would like a copy of Rita's book.
This has been The Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.
The Snapcast is a production of the Nonprofit Snapshot. Please visit us at nonprofitsnapshot.org to learn more about our consulting work and the ways we can help your organization continue to make the world a better place.